From WXXI News, this is Healthy Friday. I'm Elisa Orlando. Welcome to the program for this hour of Healthy Friday. We're going to talk about a topic we touch on frequently in our program. It's dementia. In the U.S., there are believed to be at least 5 million individuals with age-related dementias. The website Dementia Care Central estimates that there's increasing prevalence of dementia with age. They say the prevalence is 24% of those between age 80 and 89, and 37% for those age 90 and over. In the Rochester community, we have many healthcare providers and other people who are working with people who have dementia, caring for them, and also providing research and new models of care. One of those people is Dr. Alan Power. Dr. Power is Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at University of Rochester. As a geriatrician, he's also an Eden mentor. He's on the board of the Eden Alternative. Dr. Power has just completed his second book called Dementia Beyond Disease. And we're going to talk about some of the concepts in that book today, just what that term means. But in order to get the full measure of the book, and one that Dr. Power wrote before that, you have to understand where he is coming from specifically, which is why I want to ask you, Dr. Power, to explain generally what the Eden Alternative is and how it plays into, inspires, or supports your ideas about dementia and care.
It was certainly a big part of it. For about the past 20 years, there have been several organizations around the country that have been working to transform the way nursing homes look and the way people live and work there. And one of the major movements has been this movement called the Eden Alternative, which was now also branched out into home and community-based living as well. And I think the key for me in being involved with Eden was that I not only had to come up with a different way of looking at dementia, but I had to understand how organizations and living environments could transform in order to embrace new ideas. And Eden has a pathway for transforming organizations. So it was more than just giving philosophy, but saying this is how you can actually make it happen.
So it seems like in Eden, there, and we've talked about this on programs like this before, it seems like in Eden we talk about the idea of having on one level, the same people taking care of people who are elderly, of seniors, of elders. We talk about the environment. Are those the basic tenets of it, or are there some more serious sort of pathways?
There are really a variety of pathways, and it gets into very deep transformation. But there are three basic avenues. One is personal transformation, just getting a different thought process about what aging is, what elderhood is, how we should support older people. And then the second pathway is physical transformation, so changing these institutional places to places that reflect home and home values. And then the third, which I see as the linchpin, is changing operations to support those other two, because neither a holistic mindset or a beautiful building will work unless the people who are supporting the elders actually are able to flex their work in a way to meet the elders' needs in the way they'd like.
And in our community, we have some things going on that get people out of the facility setting and back into the community, things like greenhouses, and I'm sure other things that are going on where people are moving back into the community. That's a big part of it?
That is a big part of it. Matter of fact, the Greenhouse Project was founded by Bill Thomas, who's the Eden Alternative founder as well.
Okay, and that idea is that people are going back to the community, right?
It is. You know, originally it started with just people transforming houses on campus and tearing down nursing homes and putting up small houses. But St. John's Home here in Rochester did something unique in the nation in that they built their two greenhouse homes off campus, and they're actually in a real residential community about 11 miles away from their main building.
All right. Well, I want to start with the newest book because it's going to get into some of these concepts. It builds on your first book, which generally the first book, Dementia Beyond Drugs, espoused the idea that just medicating people with dementia was not the answer. Now, this book also says that interventions that are not medication-based are not the answer. So I'd like you to explain that.
Yeah.
You really kind of get into, not medication is not the answer. Medication is not the answer. So what's the answer? That's what everybody wants to know.
Yeah. Well, this is all about shifting paradigms. And I do, as you know, very early on in the prologue of my book, I have the very provocative subheading, Why Non-Pharmacologic Interventions Do Not Work. And the reason is that we're still using that same sort of medical mindset in that we choose a laundry list of things we can do for the person that are reacting to the person's distress. They may have nothing to do with who the person is or what underlying needs he or she may be expressing. And as a result, they don't really get at the real the real issue. I have a quick story I can tell that kind of goes with that. I was speaking in Iowa, and I heard about a gentleman in a rural area who had moved into an assisted living home and kept trying to go out the back door, and they kept redirecting him and trying to engage him in activities and using the non-pharmacological approaches, and he just got more insistent. And finally, at the urging of their manager, they just let him go one day, and he went to the back fence where there was a cow pasture and watched the cows for about 10 or 15 minutes, then came in and sat down, and he was fine all day. And in getting to know him, they found out he was a farmer who had to check on the cows every morning. And the problem with our typical non-pharmacological approaches is that we come up with these laundry lists. Well, let's try a hand massage. Let's try a bingo game. Let's try having him fold laundry. When really all the man wanted to do was check the cows, which was part of his prior identity. And if you don't understand that, then just using a laundry list of interventions will never get to the heart of the problem.
All right, so you use the word distress, and a lot of times, whether it's a family member or a caregiver, that's maybe the primary goal, is to avoid the distress that people feel, because we don't want to see our loved ones or our charges suffer, correct?
That's correct.
What you're saying is not to intervene, or are you just saying that an interventional mindset isn't going to work?
Well, I think that there are times when you have to respond in the moment when someone's distressed. There's no question about that. But the problem is we see that response as the solution, and we just keep applying it over and over in a reactive fashion. We don't understand what caused it, and so the distress will continue to recur.
All right, so you're talking about the medical model or the biomedical model for dementia, but we do know that dementia is a diagnosis. It's an umbrella term for a group of cognitive disorders, including Alzheimer's.
Correct.
And we think of those as they are medical issues as well as being mental health issues. So that's a tall order to try and change that sensibility, isn't it?
It is a tall order. And you know, the biomedical model, when I talk about it and when I critique it, I'm not saying that what is in there is wrong, but that it's a limited view. It's a view that only sees deficits and decline and disease and doesn't really see the whole person. And as a result, because we have such a negative deficit-based focus, we are blinded to other causes. So when someone is distressed, we're quick to say, well, they're distressed because they have dementia. Their brain disease makes them strike out at somebody or call out, when actually we're finding more and more that people have needs that the rest of us have but can't always express them in the same way.
All right. So let's talk about what the heart of the book and the meat of your book is to talk about more of a self-actualization model and the kinds of things that people, that it seems to me when I was reading it, everybody needs to be actualized. So let's talk about that a little bit. You talk about a bunch of different tenets and sort of a pyramid. Explain how you think we should be approaching people with dementia.
Okay. Well, this book is based on one paragraph I wrote in the first book where I was just kind of fishing around with the idea of what is our ultimate goal. And I talked about the concept of well-being, which goes beyond the usual quality of life measures, just because most of them are still based in medical outcomes and functional or cognitive abilities. And, you know, if you use that as your goal for well-being, then a person with dementia, by definition, could never have well-being because that's never going to get better. But there are a lot of people who said, well, what are some other things that we all need, as you said, that are universal, that go deeper, that go beyond medical illness or health? And that's where this model came from. And this model is only one of many, but it's one that I gravitated to. It's easy for me to understand and teach. And I realized that I could look at dementia actually through the lens of these seven aspects of well-being, and I could get a lot of different ideas that I didn't even have when I was writing the first book, and that's where the second book came from.
Okay, so what are the lenses? What are the seven
yeah.
things that you were how you th- we actually think as caregivers or as people who are professional caregivers, we should make lists of these seven things from the standpoint of the patient or the charge, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm. The list I happen to have chosen is one that actually came from a white paper that was commissioned by the Eden Alternative with a group of reformers who worked on this, and they came up with seven what they call domains of well-being. And those seven domains, in the order I use them in the book, are identity, connectedness, security, autonomy, meaning, growth, and joy. And the nice thing about them is they are universal across ages and cultures, but also they really do not depend on medical health or functional or cognitive ability. You can have those domains improved regardless of your medical situation.
All right. Now, you move through, and the book is sort of a handbook moving through each one of these kinds of domains. But there are a lot of things that are in the book that seem a little bit like common sense in terms of how you might want to approach somebody who's having trouble. Things like familiarity, mm-hmm. Like really knowing people. Can you explain that? Because there were a lot of cases, a lot of case studies or stories in the book where you talked about the fact that the person really needed to be known, that the staff or whoever it was that was in the situation needed to get to know the person.
Yeah, I think the example I gave of the guy with the cows is a perfect example
right.
of his identity being clear once they knew who he was. But in a larger operational sense, and this is why I said operational transformation is key, it is so important to increase familiarity for people who are forgetful. Because if you have to reacquaint yourself with strangers every time someone comes up to you, that makes your life a lot more challenging. And one of the things that I really get on my soapbox about is the fact that many long-term care communities continue to rotate their staff members to different living areas or different groups of elders. And that constantly challenges the memories of people with dementia and the trust and familiarity that, as you say, are so important to well-being.
So what you're saying is if people that have dementia can see the same people all the time, get familiar, that's great, get familiar with if it's a staff or whoever it is that's with them, that will make it easier for them to build trust.
It definitely does, because there are usually our memories that go beyond just names and dates. And emotional memories, the memories of repeated interactions with people are very durable, even with people with very significant dementia. And so we've seen again and again, and I have several examples of how a positive emotional impact that somebody makes when repeated can be very strong and can build trust and security.
You know, it would seem to me that most staff in nursing homes or in facilities of any kind are pretty caring and compassionate people. It would seem to me that they're trying to do this on a daily basis, that they're trying to know, they're trying to get familiar, they're trying to understand the people that are the elders in that facility. So why do you think that the culture isn't changing?
The people are really, you know, by and large, great people. The people I have always worked with in long-term care are amazing people. There are a couple things that form barriers. Number one, the fact that the system still tends to force people to prioritize time and task over individuals and relationships. And when it takes a bit more time to get to know somebody or to enable them to express themselves or do for themselves, and somebody's, you know, the system is telling you have to move faster and get more tasks done, that's a huge barrier. And then the other thing is just the stigma of the person fading away that comes from this biomedical view is so powerful that often people, based on their training and their experience, sell people short and don't take the time to understand the way they should.
Yeah, in both books, you actually, it seems, ask the readers to appreciate more about what's happening with people who have dementia. Can you explain that? You talk about it in much more positive terms. You don't talk about it in terms of loss.
Yeah, I think the biggest epiphany for me really came when I was trying to figure out how to write my first book. I was struggling with how I could explain that we needed to look at dementia differently. And it was really about that time that a few individuals living with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia began careers of public speaking, writing, blogging, and I got to read and hear and meet some of these people. And these people really challenged me, and I realized that their experience was something that the rest of us didn't really appreciate and couldn't ever really totally understand. And so I realized that not only was that important for me to understand, but even people who didn't make sense to me, I had to understand that they also were expressing something that I was not inhabiting. And until I really tried better to see through their eyes and understand what their situation might be, I was going to have a lot of trouble figuring out what they might need.
All right. So what did you? How did you do that? How did you sort of look through their lens, through their eyes?
Well, the first thing I think is just starting with the definition that is the central part of my first book, which is to redefine dementia simply as a shift in the way a person experiences the world around her or him. And it's fuzzy. You might think it's kind of a flaky definition. Certainly wouldn't help drug researchers. But when you do that, when you describe the process in the way that, number one, is non-stigmatized or judgmental, and number two, takes the person's perspective into account, you realize that this is really more about relativity. It's really about, depending on the perspective of the observer, the laws may change. And we have to understand what they need to succeed. And I often liken it to thinking of dementia as a disability instead of a disease, and thinking about a person in a wheelchair. We build ramps for people in wheelchairs so they can get in and out of buildings that have steps. And if you think of dementia as a disability, it occurs to you that we don't build ramps for people with dementia, meaning cognitive ramps. We put them in care environments that are based around our view of the world, our operational or staffing needs, and even at home, our schedules. And when they can't adjust with their changing brains, we medicate them with these potentially harmful drugs. And it's kind of like asking the guy in the wheelchair to walk up the steps, and if he can't walk and falls down and gets mad, giving him an antipsychotic because he has a, quote, behavior problem. We do that every day in all living environments with people with dementia.
All right. Well, I wanna get into the notion of some practical ideas that people who are not in the world of the professional world of caregiving can think about a little bit. But first, I want to just go back to the idea of drugs, because you mention it in both of the books that you have written. There are still drugs in use, and there is more of a debate these days about the use of drugs in all kinds of aspects of dementia and Alzheimer's. So where does that all lie in this? I mean, when you wrote your first book, there really weren't those kinds of debates going on about non-pharmacological interventions.
Yeah. I really was kind of one of the lone voices out there at the beginning. The evidence has built up, and there are a lot more people speaking out at this point. And the major organizations like the Medical Directors Association have come down much more forcefully against the overuse of these. But I guess we should make, particularly since this is pre-recorded, we should make the distinction between two types of drugs.
Right.
There are the drugs that are used for people who appear to be distressed or to have different personal expressions. But then there are also the drugs that are used for people to try to change the course of their dementia. The drugs like donepezil and memantine and some of those drugs that people take that are called symptomatic therapy. And when I wrote the book Dementia Beyond Drugs, I wasn't so much talking about them as these antipsychotics and other sedating types of drugs. Those drugs have also been less than exciting. They've been out for now 10 to 20 years, depending on the brand, and have not helped everybody as much as we'd like, and there really has been nothing new released in that period of time. But certainly there have been many more studies showing that the antipsychotic drugs in being used for dementia are less effective and much riskier than people used to think.
All right, so we talk about a non-pharmacological approach, but for most of the people listening to this program, they're not they may not be professional caregivers. They're people with family members or friends. What are some practical ideas that we can bring to the table that we can use from some of your approaches? I know that the person who wrote the foreword for your book, Richard Taylor, talked a lot about what it was like to be in the world and have sort of an early onset and how he was approached. But what are some of the things that we can do generally?
I think the biggest thing is, first of all, to realize that the person is still there, that they haven't gone anywhere. They may have more trouble connecting or remembering or communicating, but they are still there. And one of the most important things, I think, for family members is to be in the moment, in the present with people, not to dwell too much on who the person used to be or what they can or can't remember, but who they are today and how we can best support who they are today. And to really look at those domains of well-being and saying, what can I be doing to each day to help this person to maintain their identity, their connectedness, their security, and to go through those. Because the thing that's kind of radically different about this book is I really believe that most of the distress that doesn't have an easy solution actually comes from erosion of those domains of well-being. And rather than just react to the distress, what we need to do is build those domains back up in daily life.
You also contend that some of the most well-meaning things that happen that are the best intentions can do the most harm in some cases. Can you explain that?
They often can. And I think, once again, it's the idea of what happens when we look from our perspective instead of someone else's. And I'll give you a perfect example. This is an opinion I gave to the ethicist in the New York Times. Unfortunately, they didn't print my opinion, and the ethicist made what I consider the wrong decision. But someone wrote in about the practice of putting dark stripes on the carpet in front of elevator doors to keep people from getting on the elevator, because people with dementia often have depth perception problems, and it looks like a hole in the floor. And so the theory is we put what looks like a hole in front of the elevator, they won't try to leave.
We'll avoid it.
And what I explained to them is that a person who's trying to leave has a problem with the domain of security. They are feeling anxious and insecure in their environment, and creating something that looks like a hazard to their health, a hole in the floor, doesn't make them feel more secure and actually will probably increase their anxiety and agitation. And so once again, when we do what we think is best for people, it often has the opposite effect.
Because
alarms are the same way.
We're trying to keep them safe, right?
Yes.
We don't want them to get on the elevator, have an accident, fall, that kind of thing.
And in the book, I make the distinction between safety and security. Physical safety is only one aspect of security. But the things we do to improve physical safety, like holes in the floor or alarms, actually decrease the person's sense of security, and that actually feeds their anxiety.
You talk in the book a little bit about how to speak to people, and you just mentioned that a few minutes ago. You talk about the sports reporter analogy, and that really struck me to discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's something I've always laughed at since I was a kid. You know, ever since the old days of Howard Cosell or whoever, you know, sports reporters never ask questions. You know, Derek Jeter comes limping off the field after the Yankees lose to the Twins, and the reporter sticks the mic in his face and says, "Boy, Derek, you had a tough day out there," and then points the mic at him. And I always thought that was kind of silly, but I realized that actually is not a bad approach for a person who's very forgetful, because we speak to each other in questions. You know, you and I were just asking each other, how are things going? What have you been up to? Because we haven't seen each other for a while, and we can answer those. But if you constantly ask for information from a person who's forgetful, that's frustrating, it's embarrassing, and people usually get either self-conscious or angry. But by saying, boy, it sounds like you had a great dinner last night, I hear they had lasagna, that gives the person space to fill in however they like, with whatever degree of detail or accuracy they like. They set the parameters. They don't have to be right or wrong. And it's a much more enabling way. And it gives the person the ability to choose his or her own level of depth and response and detail.
As a physician and a medical director and a geriatrician, when you see families or friends with elders, or in your case elders, because you're probably mostly around elders, or people with dementia or Alzheimer's, what do you observe most about family and friends? What are we all trying to do and get to? We feel like maybe we're trying to support. We want the person in our life to have the best that they can have. But what do you observe?
Mm-hmm. I observe two big things that are overwhelming, and they're both nobody's fault, and they're both very true, but they both have a negative effect. One is the grief that people feel because the person they love is changing. And often when it's a family member, it's more than just somebody I know whose abilities are changing, but also this person had a familial role that is opposed to me, so it might be my parent, my spouse, my brother or sister. And that changing of roles and that loss of who that person was in your life can be very, very difficult for people. And once again, there's no easy way around grief. It has to happen, and people have to be supported through it. The other thing I see is the struggles to support people in the community. We have communities that are very poorly designed for aging in general. Community supports for people with dementia, in spite of good groups like the Alzheimer's Association or Lifespan, if you don't have a lot of money, you can't get a lot of help in the home. So I see spouses who may be older themselves, or I see working sons and daughters who are working themselves to the bone trying to be the doctor, nurse, social worker, aide for this person 24/7. And it's a tough system to care for people in.
All right, you talk a lot in the book, and you've talked in the past. What keeps coming up over and over again is this sort of theme of inclusion, which is something we associate with the world of disabilities oftentimes, mm-hmm. and also this idea of segregation. It seems to creep into all of your conversations. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I become kind of notorious for my segregation opinion. And in my first book, I have just one page about it. And in that page, I predict that what I was about to write would be the most controversial part of the book. And it turns out it was. And that was really that I don't think that we should have so-called dementia care or memory care homes, either at skilled or assisted living levels. I really believe we should continue to have integrated living areas for people with dementia and people without cognitive change. And whatever the living situation, I think we should strive for that. And I give a variety of reasons in both books that we can go into if you like.
Yeah, I would like to.
There are a lot of reasons. The biggest one, I think the place where it starts and ends, I think, is the civil rights argument that nowadays, other than convicted prisoners, there's no one else that we say can't live with the rest of us. We've deinstitutionalized people with developmental disabilities, people with psychiatric illness. We've gone through civil rights. We've gone through gay rights. And all of a sudden, here's this group that has to be moved away as soon as they show a sign of change in cognition. So I think that basically it's unjust at the most basic way. But also, there has been no proof that segregating people improves their care. And if anything, it may be harmful. And what I do in the new book, to take the argument further, is I actually, in each of the well-being chapters, I show how segregating people can actually erode that domain of well-being for the mm-hmm. people. And once again, we're trying to be kind. We're trying to put people in an environment that we think will be better for them. But in many ways, it causes us to generalize, to say, okay, well, people with dementia should live like this. They should have this kind of activity. They should have this kind of environment. And that is sort of the opposite of individualized care when you think of it. We're making sweeping generalizations based on an illness rather than on the individuals.
But given that it is something that is diagnosed, that it is a condition, and there is sort of a standard of care, I mean, aren't some of the procedures and the things in place workable for people? Are you saying we should just throw the whole thing out the window?
I think what happens is people start to have the cookie-cutter approach to how they interact with people and forget that they're individuals. So I guess the best analogy I can give is, suppose I were to come to a group of people and say, okay, everybody with diabetes, we all treat you with insulin, we all check your blood sugars, so now you have to all live together. You can't live with your other neighbors. We're going to move you to a different place because this is the way way you think we think you should live. And really, I think we have to move away from that because I think it actually does more harm than good when we
do that. So you're talking about place more than standard of care.
It's both. It's place and standard of care. I mean, we want to give, obviously, humane care to people. But once again, what we see happening is, and this is, you know, built right into the formal education, for example, of rec therapists. Once again, an incredible group of people, but a lot of their formal education tells them to use deficit-based scales like the Global Deterioration Scale to measure in a very sort of general way people's capabilities and then to match them to stage-specific activities. So if you have a score of X or Y, all the people with that scale get the same activity offered. But, you know, if you have John who's a married farmer with eight kids and loves baseball, and you have Mary who's a single school teacher that likes crossword puzzles, if they have the same score on a GDS, it doesn't mean that they should be offered the same kind of living options or activity options. And so those generalizations actually tend to erode the individuality of the people.
Do you believe that individualized care that will take a little more time, you have many references in the book about how taking a little more time, you took a little bit more time with somebody and you learned a little more and rectified a situation that might have been distressing in the moment. Is there any doubt that that's going to be expensive?
Well, you know, there are lots of ways you can do it. And what I've done in teaching my courses is I've been very pragmatic because, you know, we could say, boy, wouldn't it be great if we had another $1 million and 15 more staff members and all the time in the world. But those are three things I can't give anybody, time, money, or additional help. And so what I really talk about are what are the little things we can do. And the amazing thing is that, and particularly now talking about institutional care, there's nothing efficient about it. Even though we talk about focusing on time, this idea of having people that are focused on tasks instead of people who work in departments that don't necessarily collaborate well with each other, it's actually less efficient. And I gave a great example yesterday when I was in Toronto of people that are in a hurry and someone's walking too slowly to get to the dining room. So they think, well, I'm in a hurry, so to make my life easier, I'll give them a ride down to the dining room every day. But when they do that, the person's ability to walk actually declines. And next thing they know, it takes two of them to get the person out of bed. They've just increased their workload by a huge amount because they were trying to be efficient. And so that's the payoff if you try to rush too much.
All right. You talk a lot about language, obviously about perceptions, but you talk about language related not just to dementia, but also to the general idea of aging. You talk about the fact that we use the term silver tsunami, for example, and you bring up some ideas about what we really must do to change our thinking and our perceptions because basically of the number of people that are going to be around to take care of us when we get older. Would you talk about that a little bit?
I'm glad you came back to that. And you know, you do such great homework on these books and because you're taking me back to the segregation question. What I really get to in the last chapter of my new book is the reason I have all these arguments about not segregating people with dementia is because the larger picture is that with our aging population, even the idea of moving older people to, quote, senior living campuses is a doomed strategy. Because the way our population is aging, you know, in 1950, there were approximately 12 working adults for every retired adult. In 2000, it was 9-1. And in 2050, the way we're aging, there will be about 4 working adults for every retired adult. So the idea of moving older people to senior living campuses is folly because who's going to build and operate those? And so we have to start today thinking about a whole different kind of inclusion than we've thought about before.
All right. So in the foreword to the book by Dr. Richard Taylor, PhD, who talks about having a diagnosis and the way that people approached him as soon as he said that he had the condition, there's something there about the idea of early onset in this community. I mean, this community is home to a big lot of genetic testing about understanding what markers might be for Alzheimer's specifically. And there's a lot of the talk around Alzheimer's and dementia these days seems to be about trying to figure out whether or not you have it and would you want to know whether you have it. What the ideas that you're talking about really aren't about that.
No, and you know, that's a very controversial area. I see both sides of the issue. I see the researchers who believe that if people knew that they were at risk or were developing it early, they might be able to get into trials of new medications that might eventually be developed that might slow the process. Right now, we have no medication that slows or stops the process. On the other side, I see the people say, well, you know, the stigma is so great. I get treated by society like so much less of a person once I have that label. That why would I want to know ahead of time and have people start taking away from me based on their feeling of what I can and can't accomplish? So I see both sides, and I think the solution really is to really create well-being for people living with dementia so that it becomes less stigmatized and so it becomes less of a fear for people to get the information they need and to get the help they need. And I think that once again gets back to segregation, because the biggest argument against segregation is that the well elders don't like people with dementia living near them. And once again, that comes from their deep fear of what could happen to me, and I don't want to see this. And the best way to combat that is to treat those people that live in their neighborhood with the kind of respect that they would want if they become forgetful later, so that we can decrease that fear. And I was doing an interview a while back where someone asked me, you know, as I'm getting older, do I worry about getting dementia? And it doesn't occupy my mind that much. It could happen to me, certainly. But I think that this idea of working on creating well-being has convinced me that there is a path to a meaningful life, even if you develop a condition like dementia. And it's not something, you know, just to be abhorred quite the way society is doing it right now.
All right, Dr. Ellen Power, let me ask you for the last question then. You use a lot of small examples in the book, little stories of things that went right for people, that whether you took more time or somebody took more time or a caregiver raised her hand and said, what if I did this or did something a little bit different. Is there a particular story in your mind of a path of a particular person that did go very well, where they really were able to keep their dignity, have well-being as they move through the process?
I was doing a seminar down in Kentucky and heard from a woman who supports many organizations around the Midwest, travels around, that she was in the Midwest supporting one organization, and the staff asked her for assistance with a gentleman who they considered to be very difficult and very nasty. Since he had come in, they had called him belligerent. He had been resisting all kinds of care. He wouldn't come out of his room. He wouldn't join people for meals or activities. And so this worker who supports people and teaches them how better to care for people with dementia went in and talked to the gentleman for just about 15 minutes and got to know him a bit. And she came back out and said to the group, do you know anything about this gentleman, about his history? And they said, no, we just know that he's very difficult. And she said, did you know that he was an engineer and he helped design the It's a Small World ride for Disney? And they were flabbergasted. They had no idea that he had done that. And she said, maybe next time you go in there, you should talk to him about that. And when they began to ask him about his history, he became very animated. He started talking about it. The staff began to see him as a different person. They began to see other dimensions to him besides a person who was in a nursing home with dementia. Some of the maintenance guys caught word, and they would invite him to come out on some of their maintenance projects and give his opinions based on all the things he used to build. And so he started doing that, and then he got invited by the rec therapist to come to activities and explain his history of working for Disney to other elders. And before you know it, he was out of his room participating, very pleasant with all those around him, and became quite a delightful person to know and care for.
Oh, good. A lovely story. That's a great way to have the last word. So thank you for the story.
Thank you.
Dr. Ellen Power is the author of the book Dementia Beyond Disease, and that book is due out this summer. Also an Eden Mentor and Clinical Associate Professor at University of Rochester. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lisa.
We appreciate it. We'd like to know what you think of this interview and of some of the ideas that Dr. Power was talking about. Please feel free to find us on Facebook and leave a comment there. We'll take a short break on Healthy Friday and be back with more right after this. Coming up in the next hour of Healthy Friday, join Matthew Leonard and Michelle Faust from the 4th Annual North American Refugee Health Conference. They'll be talking about getting affordable coverage for refugees and the unique health challenges faced by refugee communities throughout North America. That's coming up next on Healthy Friday on WXXI and WEOS, public radio for Rochester and the Finger Lakes. Welcome back to Healthy Friday. You're listening today on WXXI and on WEOS. So glad that you can join us. We are approaching the first full day of summer coming up tomorrow. The summer solstice arrives at 6:51 a.m. tomorrow if you're reaching for your almanac right now. And that hour might be one of the only times of day you might be safe to be out in the sunlight. The summer season means the shorts come out, the sleeves go away, and after the winter we've had in upstate New York, lots of us are going to want to get outside and enjoy the sun. But there is a risk that goes along with the sun, and that risk, of course, is skin cancer. There are three important facts about that risk. Skin cancer is the most common form of cancer in the United States. Also, each year there are more new cases of skin cancer than the combined incidence of cancers of the breast, prostate, lung, and colon, and treatment of skin cancer that is not melanoma has increased by nearly 77%. up to 2006, between 1992 and 2006. Dr. Brett Shulman is with us today via the telephone. He's the head of the Center for Dermatology, part of Rochester General's health system. Dr. Shulman, still a surprising statistic that skin cancer is the most common form of cancer, 2 million people diagnosed every year. Why are we surprised by that, do you think?
Well, you know, I think that certainly we are seeing that people have had more access to ultraviolet light in the last 20 years than ever before. And we know that the majority of skin cancers are actually produced by exposure to ultraviolet light. And sunscreen use has unfortunately not reached the kinds of levels that we would hope that they would. So given the fact that people are being exposed to more ultraviolet light and that sunscreen use is not as commonplace as it should be, I think that a lot of that is contributing to the increases in skin cancer that we're seeing. And all skin cancers are increasing. So we're seeing increases in basal cells, squamous cells, and unfortunately we're also seeing increases in malignant melanoma.
But we really, as we move through into our summer months, we also see lots of sunscreen. Many of us are carrying sunscreen with us when we go out in the sun. It seems like in terms of awareness, there is a high awareness of the need to use sunscreen. It just seems like those two ideas, at least what we see in the media and what you're describing, people not really being protected, they don't really go together.
Well, I think that what happens is a lot of this is really the educational component. And so that I think that a lot of people are what I call binge sunscreen users or episodic sunscreen users. So if they know they're going out on the boat, they will use the sunscreen, or if they're going to go play golf or tennis or whatever. But what I think that a lot of people forget about is that every time we are outdoors, we're exposed to ultraviolet light. So I like analogies, and I use the analogy of a seatbelt. You just don't put a seatbelt on when you think you're going to get into a car accident. You put a seatbelt on every time you get in your car. What we need are sunscreens that people apply every day. And part of that right now is that we don't have the best vehicles to support that. Now, there are some things that are coming online that are very exciting, where we are actually combining body washes and shampoos with sunscreens so that when you get out of the shower, you have both sunscreen as well as a clean body. And these will make things easier, just as the combined shoulder harness and seatbelt have done. And I am hoping that is going to end up leading to easier use of sunscreen and more use of sunscreen.
So what you're saying is that because it's another product that we get out of the shower, we have to then, you know, maybe we have lotion that we want to put on. It's not in every lotion. It's in a lot of facial products, and it's in a lot of makeup, I know. But what you're saying is that if we have one less thing to do, we might actually do it. And it seems to me that we may think of sunscreen, or at least I think of sunscreen in some cases, as a barrier. So it seems a little counterintuitive that in soap it would be present.
Well, some of this utilizes some very, very clever polymer technology. So in a lot of respects, we're dealing with finally some chemistry that allows us to put together things that don't necessarily want to go together. The other thing to realize is that sunscreen that's in the makeup or that sunscreen that you're applying to your skin is only really lasting, in most cases, between 1 and 3 hours. So the second problem with sunscreen really is reapplication. So you have people who are good about putting sunscreen on, but then at points 2 to 4 hours, they're not really good about reapplication. So sunscreen needs to not just be applied, but it needs to be reapplied during what we call the peak hours, which are between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's when the energies are actually the strongest, and they are the ones that are most damaging to the skin itself.
So when we put sunscreen on, when we go out and into our day, if we have a job where we work inside, does it really matter?
Well, some ultraviolet light actually goes through window glass. So if you look at the spectrum, ultraviolet A, ultraviolet B, which are the two that we deal with, there is also something called ultraviolet C, but it's actually it's screened out by the ozone layer. Ultraviolet A actually has sufficient energy to go through window glass. So if you're in an occupation where you're driving a lot, if you're in an occupation where, you know, you're right next to the window, you are probably getting some ultraviolet A radiation coming through the window glass itself. So it is an argument for utilizing sunscreen every day. It is probably a smaller component of what is leading to this tremendous increase in skin cancer, though.
All right. So I want to talk about what's leading to the tremendous increase. Could part of that be the fact that we're just discovering it sooner because people are more vigilant about looking at moles and things?
Well, some of it is, but people actually have done studies in this area to look to see whether this is just increased detection or whether or not it's increased incidence. And it turns out that it's actually a little bit of both, but it's far more increased incidence than it is actually increased detection. So when I started my career in dermatology, the incidence of developing a melanoma was about 1 in 1,200 live births. This year, we will be at 1 in 88. So there's been a tremendous increase in the incidence of melanoma. And again, I think it's probably multifactorial, and it's also probably some of it is environmental. I mean, our ozone layer is not any thicker than it was back when I started. So we really need to sort of do what people have done in other countries. And Australia is probably the best example, where in Queensland, Australia, the incidence of melanoma was highest in the world. It also turned out to be Queensland is right over where the biggest hole in the ozone layer is. And they've started out on a public education campaign now almost 20 years in length, in which they have educated people about utilizing both physical sunscreens, which is clothing, and chemical sunscreens, which is sunscreens and sun blocks. And they have actually seen their incidence of melanoma plateau and start to decrease. So there is really value in public education and self-protection to reduce what is really, I call, an epidemic of skin cancer right now.
Let's go back to that 1 in 88 number before we talk about the idea of covering up. When you started your career, we may not have had as much awareness about the use of sunscreen either. So what's going on? Are we just in the sun more? Are we not listening? I mean, the sunscreen is there. People are using it sometimes.
Well, the data on sunscreen is unfortunately disappointing right now. The data shows that if you look at adults using sunscreen on a regular basis, it's about 20 to 25% of the eligible population. And if you look at children, it's about 35%. So we still have a very significant number of individuals who go out into the world and are not protecting themselves. And now what we're looking at is that it's easier to end up getting on a plane and going to the Bahamas or the Caribbean or wherever where people are getting very high ultraviolet exposures. It's possible to go into tanning salons and get ultraviolet light 365 days a year. And when you look at all these things and understand that the damage is cumulative, so it's not one of these sort of things where if I'm good later on, all of what I've done goes away. Each unit of energy adds on to each previous unit of energy. And so I think that some of this is really how we've changed as a society, and so we've created a risk that is very formidable.
By being able to travel to the sun and the ultraviolet light, by being able to use it for artificial tans and things like that.
Absolutely.
What about, I think I read an article last week about the ultraviolet light used in things like nail salons and those kinds of things.
You know, that's also an interesting question because, you know, ultraviolet light is used in the nail salons to cure the nails because when you use artificial nail products, what you're doing is you're converting something which is a monomer into something that's a polymer that's hard. They actually use ultraviolet A light to do this, and people actually put their hands into a box-like device. I think there's really kind of, in that industry, there's kind of two risks. One are the people who go on a regular basis because the intensity of the light is pretty high. And I encourage, when patients ask me this question, because this has been sort of a on-and-off-again issue for the last year or two, I encourage them to wear gloves and just cut out the finger pieces if that's really, you know, they feel that they really want to do this. And I think the second risk are people who are in the industry itself because there's a certain amount of ultraviolet light that does sort of, in for lack of a better word, splash back. And those people are going to be exposed 5 days a week, 40 hours a week. So they're getting a larger cumulative exposure than I think anybody thinks about. So there's an element of a public health hazard here that we need to think about.
It seems to me, just to be fair, that the study I read said that the risk was relatively small or that there's a relatively small amount of exposure under these lights. But I guess if people go a lot...
In any one session, it's very small. But if you, let's say you go monthly to have your nails done, or you work in this industry and who work in this industry. This may be just sort of we're seeing the tip of the iceberg. But then again, I mean, I don't think that this should be a panic moment, and I don't think that if you want to do this, that you shouldn't do this. But, you know, how it would not be that difficult to actually protect the majority of your hands and just let your nails be exposed.
And your bigger issue really has to do with the regular use of sunscreen and the proper use of sunscreen. So let's talk a little bit about sunscreen itself can be confusing. The guidelines changed a couple of years ago, I guess it was, or maybe a year ago. So what should we be looking for?
Okay.
And how often and how thickly should we be applying it? Because I understand you have to put a lot on.
Yeah. So there are a couple of things. There are two things that in the guidelines that changed. The first is the concept of what constitutes broad-spectrum sunscreen. And in order for a sunscreen to be designated as broad-spectrum, it needs to protect against both ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B light. The other is the concept of water resistance, and people used to use terms like waterproof. There are no waterproof sunscreens, and currently, water-resistant sunscreens will either be labeled to be water-resistant for 40 minutes or 90 minutes, but they need to be reapplied after that. Sweating also and rubbing reduces the sunscreen barrier function. The second thing that's important is understanding what SPF means. And SPF stands for sun protection factor. And SPF is actually a measure of how much time you are protected as opposed to if you weren't wearing any sunscreen at all. It is not a measure of how much or how little you'll tan. So higher SPFs don't mean that you'll tan less. What they do mean is that you'd have longer amounts of protection. Now, going back to what we talked about before, which is that most sunscreens are wearing off between 1 and 4 hours, sunscreens that are over 30 don't traditionally provide any additional benefit because the sunscreen wears off long before you could get that time benefit. The other thing to understand is that the numbers that are being produced are produced in a laboratory, where the actual thickness of the sunscreen is about double what most people put on their skin. So what you really want to make sure you're doing is putting on sunscreen. There are many vehicles. There are sprays. There are lotions. There are gels. There are any number of sunscreens that are available, including some of these more clever materials we've talked about, which are the sprays and the products that can be put on in the bath area, in the bathroom area. But it's just important to find a vehicle that you like, that cosmetically feels good, and then needs to be reapplied every 2 to 4 hours.
You're listening to Healthy Friday on WXXI and WEOS, public radio for Rochester and the Finger Lakes. We're talking about skin cancer today and sunscreen with Dr. Brett Shulman, the head of the Center for Dermatology in Rochester, part of Rochester General Health System. Dr. Shulman, at the beginning, you mentioned these new products, and you just talked about them again. Are these things on the market now, these washes and things that we can use very easily without having this extra product called sunscreen?
Yeah, yes, they are commercially available, and certainly you can either search for them on the Internet or you can contact our office, and I would be more than happy to share with you where you can reach them.
We've been talking about the high incidence, 1 in 88 of skin cancer, of melanoma, and I know that recently celebrities like Hugh Jackman have gone out and said he tweeted or put on Instagram a picture of himself with a bandage on his nose. He had a basal cell carcinoma, I believe, and talked about the importance of sunscreen. Celebrities help you out with this, or is this something that's not really sexy enough other than Hugh Jackman going out there and talking about it? I haven't seen much in the media about skin cancer and the use of sunscreen other than basic news stories.
Well, actually, celebrities are very good about this, and many celebrities have actually raised awareness, and you do see a large number of people actually coming in for examination. Perhaps I think the person who was most forthright about this, and this is not a political comment at all, but when Ronald Reagan had two basal cells removed from his nose, the incidence of people coming in for screening really skyrocketed. Bill Clinton has had skin cancer removed. There are a variety of people out there who have had skin cancers close to home. The coach for the Buffalo Bills recently appears to have had a skin cancer removed. So, you know, I think any of these things, people really do have an affinity for news, and celebrities are really a good vehicle to get an educational message out there. so that when this happens, I think that the awareness goes up and then people look at themselves a little bit more carefully. And that's another thing that I think you really want to do, is to understand that skin cancer in most cases is curable if it's caught early enough. So it's really important that in addition to using sunscreen, that people should do monthly self-examination and look at all parts of their body and looking to see if there's anything on their skin that either is changing in size, shape, color, texture, or possibly bleeding, or something that has been there, something that has not been there and is now new. Those are the sorts of things I think dermatologists are really good at being able to either give you reassurance and guidance, or identifying an early skin cancer and taking care of a problem that could have been bigger later down the road.
So the takeaways are wear your sunscreen and keep an eye on yourself. Look for changes, look for moles, look for things that look unusual.
Absolutely.
Dr. Brett Schulman, thanks very much for your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for listening. A reminder that the information presented on Healthy Friday is just that. It's medical information, not advice. If you have a healthcare concern, please consult your healthcare provider. Michelle Faust and Matthew Leonard pick up the next hour of Healthy Friday from the Refugee Health Conference in upstate New York. And later on All Things Considered, one local government is rolling out a new policy on breastfeeding. That story is coming up later. I'm Elisa Orlando. I hope you enjoy your weekend. We'll see you next month for another edition of Healthy Friday on WXXI and WEOS, public radio for Rochester and the Finger Lakes.